A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's a thing that happened in Jerusalem recently. Multiple infants collapsed at home. Parents rush them to the hospital. Toxicology comes back. Benzodiazepine. And the traceback leads to baby food purchased from a single supermarket chain. Someone put benzos in jars of baby food.
I saw this story break and my first reaction was, I'm a retired pediatrician. I've seen a lot of things walk through an ER door, but this one made me stop cold. The clinical picture alone is terrifying. You have an infant who was fine, who suddenly becomes lethargic, hypotonic, respiratory depression sets in. The parents have no explanation. They didn't give the child any medication. And then the lab work comes back and you're staring at a benzodiazepine screen that's positive. That's not an accidental ingestion. That's not a dosing error. That's something else entirely.
That's exactly what Daniel wrote in about. He sent us this prompt after the news broke. He's a parent himself, and he was asking two things. First, what can parents actually look for to spot tampered food before they serve it? And second, is there any historical precedent for this kind of food terrorism globally? But he also said something important up front. He reminded us that the statistical probability of encountering tampered baby food is probably a fraction of the chance of being struck by lightning. So this isn't about panic. It's about understanding.
That's the tightrope right there. You have an event that is every parent's nightmare. Something that feels almost designed to trigger the deepest protective instincts we have. And at the same time, it's so statistically rare that the rational response is essentially, keep doing what you're doing, the system works. Holding both of those truths at once is hard. Our brains aren't wired for it.
They really aren't. The parent who heard about this case and spent the next 3 nights staring at baby food jars in their kitchen. I understand that parent. I am that parent, temperamentally. But the data says that parent is responding to a threat that is, for all practical purposes, not there. And the question is whether we can replace that vague anxiety with something more useful. Actual things to check. A framework for thinking about risk that doesn't dismiss the fear, but doesn't inflate it either.
That's what we're going to do today. We're going to walk through the known facts of the Jerusalem case, what we know and what we don't. We're going to look at the history of product tampering and food terrorism, because these events have happened before and they follow patterns. And then we're going to get into the actual mechanics of tamper-evident packaging, how it works, where it fails, and what a parent can realistically spot at home. The goal here is not to scare anyone. The facts are unsettling enough on their own. The goal is to give you the tools to be informed without being afraid.
I think the reason this case landed so hard, beyond the obvious horror of it, is that baby food occupies this unique psychological space. It's one of the few product categories where the consumer is completely vulnerable and has zero ability to advocate for themselves. You're feeding it to someone who can't tell you it tastes wrong, can't describe symptoms, can't say anything at all. That's what makes the tampering feel like such a profound violation.
And it's also what makes the supply chain security question so acute. Baby food manufacturing is supposed to be one of the most tightly regulated sectors in the food industry. The safety standards are incredibly detailed. The fact that a sedative ended up in clinically significant concentrations in a product designed for infants, that's not a quality control lapse. That's not a contamination accident. That's an intentional act. And that changes how we have to think about it. Let's lay out what we actually know. The case broke in Jerusalem. Multiple infants, all under 1 year old, presented at emergency departments with sedation, hypotonia, and in some cases respiratory depression severe enough to require ventilation support. Toxicology screening came back positive for benzodiazepine. These are not drugs that show up in an infant's system by accident. And the epidemiological traceback, which is the unglamorous but crucial work of asking every family what the child ate, where they bought it, when they opened it, converged on baby food from a single supermarket chain.
Which narrows things considerably. You've got multiple victims, no familial connection, but a shared product and a shared point of purchase. That's the signature of supply chain contamination, not household error. And the criminal investigation is active. Police have said it's being treated as suspected deliberate contamination. They haven't used the word terrorism yet, and that restraint is probably appropriate.
It is, because we genuinely don't know the motive. Everyone's instinct is to call this terrorism, and it may turn out to be exactly that. But deliberate contamination covers a wider set of possibilities. It could be ideological. It could be extortion against the supermarket chain or the manufacturer. It could be a disgruntled employee. It could be someone with a personal grievance that had nothing to do with politics. The one thing we can say with reasonable confidence is that this was not accidental. Benzodiazepines don't drift into baby food jars through a manufacturing error. Someone put them there.
The choice of agent is worth noting. Benzodiazepine is a sedative, not a lethal poison. At the doses these infants received, it was medically serious. But it's not cyanide. It's not ricin. If your goal is to kill, you pick something else. If your goal is to terrorize, to create chaos, to make parents afraid of the food they feed their children, a sedative that causes collapse, but is treatable in a hospital setting, does that job quite effectively.
That's a clinical observation that I think gets missed in the initial shock of the story. These children survived. They were hospitalized, they received supportive care, and they recovered. That doesn't make it less disturbing. In some ways, it makes the psychology of the perpetrator more unsettling, because it suggests someone who understood exactly what they were doing and calibrated the outcome.
That's the factual picture. A deliberate act, a sedative rather than a lethal agent, an active investigation with no announced motive. And what we're going to do for the rest of this episode is pull on two threads. First, the historical thread. Has this happened before? And what patterns emerge when you line up the cases? And second, the practical thread. What does tamper-evident packaging actually do? Where are its weak points? And what can a parent realistically check at home?
I want to be clear about what we are not doing. We are not going to speculate about who did this or why. We're not going to rank supermarket chains by safety. We're not going to suggest anyone stop buying jarred baby food. What we are going to do is replace the vague dread that a story like this creates with something more useful, specific knowledge about how these systems work and where they can fail. Let's start with the history, because these events are rare, but they're not unprecedented. The archetype, the case that reshaped how we think about product tampering, is the Chicago Tylenol murders of 1982. 7 people died. All of them had taken extra-strength Tylenol capsules that had been laced with potassium cyanide. The victims were strangers to each other, different neighborhoods, different pharmacies. The only connection was the product.
The mechanism was chillingly simple. Someone, and this case is still unsolved, by the way, someone took bottles off store shelves, opened the capsules, replaced some of the acetaminophen powder with cyanide, and put the bottles back. No forced entry, no supply chain breach in the conventional sense. Just a person in a store, with a steady hand and a complete disregard for human life.
The death toll was 7, but the real impact was orders of magnitude larger. Johnson & Johnson, the parent company, pulled 31 million bottles of Tylenol from shelves nationwide. That cost them over $100 million. But here's the thing. They were praised for it. They prioritized public safety over profit, and it set a standard. More importantly, the FDA responded by mandating tamper-evident packaging for all over-the-counter medications. That regulation, the 1983 Federal Anti-Tampering Act, is the reason every bottle of pills you buy today has a foil seal, a shrink band, or a breakaway cap.
That regulatory framework is the direct ancestor of the tamper-evident features we now see on baby food jars. The vacuum button, the shrink band, the induction seal. Those didn't appear because baby food manufacturers spontaneously decided to be more careful. They exist because cyanide and Tylenol capsules killed 7 people in Chicago 44 years ago.
The Tylenol case also spawned a wave of copycat tampering incidents throughout the 1980s. Most were hoaxes or extortion attempts. But the pattern was established: a diffuse product, a distributed retail footprint, and a perpetrator who never has to face the victim. That's the psychological profile that recurs.
Then, in 1984, you get a different category of attack. The Rajni Shi bioterrorism incident in the Dallas, Oregon. A religious cult deliberately contaminated salad bars with salmonella. 751 people got sick. 45 were hospitalized. And the motivation wasn't murder. It was voter suppression. The cult wanted to incapacitate enough of the local population to swing a county election.
That case is remarkable because it's the first confirmed bioterror attack on U.S. soil, and it used food as the vector. Salad bars, specifically, another diffuse, low-margin product where traceability is a nightmare. The outbreak was initially attributed to poor food handling by restaurant staff. It wasn't until a year later, when a cult member bragged about it at a meeting that was secretly recorded, that investigators realized what had actually happened.
The lesson from the Dallas is that food terrorism doesn't always announce itself. If the cult hadn't been infiltrated, we might still classify that outbreak as a routine food safety failure. Which raises an uncomfortable question. How many other contamination events that we've written off as accidents were actually deliberate?
It's a disturbing thought, but the epidemiological data doesn't support the idea that this is a hidden epidemic. The CDC estimates roughly 1 in 100,000 food products are tampered with annually in the United States. That's not 1 in 100,000 meals. It's 1 in 100,000 products across the entire supply chain. These events are globally newsworthy precisely because they are so rare.
Then there's the 1989 Chilean grape scare. Two grapes found with cyanide in Philadelphia. That's it. The entire Chilean fruit industry lost over $200 million. Import screening protocols were rewritten, and the case remains unsolved. The FDA never found any additional contaminated fruit, and some investigators later suggested it might have been a deliberate act of economic sabotage rather than a public health threat.
Which brings us to the common pattern across all three cases. The attacker targets a product that is widely distributed, purchased frequently, and consumed by a broad population. The supply chain is complex enough that tracing the point of contamination is extremely difficult, and the fear amplification is automatic. You don't need to contaminate every jar, you just need to contaminate enough to make headlines.
Now contrast all of that with the Jerusalem case. The Tylenol killer used cyanide, a lethal agent. The Rajni Shis used salmonella, a pathogen designed to cause mass illness. The Chilean grape incident involved cyanide again. But the Jerusalem perpetrator used benzodiazepine, something that causes collapse and hospitalization, but is treatable. That's a different intent.
It really is. In clinical terms, benzodiazepine at the doses these infants received causes respiratory depression and hypotonia. It looks terrifying, and it is medically serious. But with supportive care in a hospital setting, the prognosis is generally good. If you wanted to kill, you'd use an opioid, or cyanide, or any number of agents that are harder to reverse. The choice of a sedative suggests someone who wanted the drama of the hospital admission, the news coverage, the parental panic, without necessarily wanting fatalities.
Which could point to extortion rather than terrorism in the ideological sense. A threat that says, I can do this, and I can do it again, and here's what I want in exchange. Or it could point to a disgruntled employee who wanted to hurt the company's reputation without crossing the line into mass murder. We don't know, but the weapon choice is a clue about the psychology, and it doesn't match the classic terrorist profile.
The other thing that makes the Jerusalem case unusual is the target. Not over-the-counter medication that adults take, not salad bars that anyone might visit. Baby food, a product purchased exclusively by parents for the most vulnerable consumers imaginable. That's a deliberate choice to maximize emotional impact. The perpetrator wasn't just trying to create fear. They were trying to create a specific kind of fear. The fear that you can't protect your child from something as basic as what you feed them.
That's exactly why Daniel's question about vigilance matters. Because the fear is real, even if the statistical risk is negligible. The next step is understanding what we can actually do about it, what the packaging is supposed to tell us, and where it might lie.
The vacuum button is the one most parents recognize. It's that little dome in the center of the lid. When the jar is properly sealed at the factory, the contents are hot, they cool, the air inside contracts, and that creates negative pressure that pulls the button down. You see it depressed, you hear that satisfying pop when you first open it, and you know the seal was intact. At least, that's the theory.
The theory has a hole in it.
A syringe with a fine-gauge needle can pierce the rubber gasket under the lid, inject a liquid contaminant, and leave almost no visible trace. The vacuum remains intact because you haven't introduced enough air to equalize the pressure. The button stays down. The jar looks factory fresh.
That's the mechanism that showed up in a 2010 case in Michigan. A man was caught on store surveillance, injecting something into baby food jars on the shelf. He was arrested before anyone was harmed, but the method he used, syringe through the seal, is exactly what I just described. It's not hypothetical. Someone has done this.
The other vulnerability with the vacuum button is heat. If you warm the jar gently, not enough to cook the contents, just enough to expand the air inside, the button pops back up. Let it cool, the button depresses again. You've now reset the tamper indicator. It takes patience and a hot water bath, but it's not sophisticated. Anyone who's ever canned their own jam understands the principle.
The vacuum button is a good first line of defense, but it's not foolproof. What about shrink bands? Those plastic sleeves around the lid and neck of the jar.
Shrink bands work on a simple principle. A plastic sleeve is placed over the closed lid, heat is applied, and the sleeve shrinks tightly around the contours of the lid and the neck of the jar. To open the jar, you have to tear or cut the band. A missing or damaged band is an obvious red flag. But here's the weakness. The band can be removed with a solvent that loosens the adhesive, the jar can be opened and tampered with, and a new shrink band can be applied using a heat gun. Industrial shrink banding equipment isn't hard to obtain. You can buy a handheld heat gun at any hardware store.
We're in an arms race between packaging engineers and people with bad intentions, and the packaging engineers are playing defense. What about the pouches? The plastic squeeze pouches that have basically taken over the baby food aisle.
Pouches use induction seals. An aluminum foil laminate is placed over the opening, and an electromagnetic field heats the foil, bonding it to the plastic rim of the pouch. It creates a hermetic seal, completely airtight. When you unscrew the cap, you should see that foil membrane intact. You have to physically pierce it or peel it off. A failed induction seal will look wrinkled, partially detached, or you'll see product residue on top of the foil where it shouldn't be.
The weakness there?
Same syringe problem, different entry point. You don't go through the seal, you go through the side of the pouch, which is flexible laminate. A pinhole in the middle of a colorful cartoon-decorated pouch is almost invisible. And the pouch is under much less vacuum pressure than a glass jar, so there's no obvious physical indicator that it's been breached.
The packaging features we're talking about are real barriers, but they're barriers against casual tampering, the impulsive act, the person in the warehouse who gets an angry idea, against a determined, methodical actor, their speed bumps.
Which brings us to the supply chain itself. Baby food manufacturing involves contract packers, companies that produce product for multiple brands on the same line. A jar of store brand baby food might come from the same facility as a premium organic label. Co-packing arrangements mean the traceability gets fuzzy. Then there's the retail level. Jars get dropped, boxes get opened for individual sale, employees restock shelves. The last mile from the stockroom to the shelf is the hardest to secure.
Defensive purchasing, then, is about understanding those failure points and doing a few quick checks that take maybe 10 seconds. Check the vacuum button. It should be fully depressed and not move when you press it. If it clicks or flexes, don't buy it. Inspect the shrink band, look for tears, glue residue, or a band that's slightly misaligned, which suggests it was reapplied. Look at the label. If it's crooked or has bubbles underneath, that's a possible sign the jar was opened and relabeled. Avoid jars with dents near the rim, because a dent can compromise the seal without breaking the glass.
One more. Buy from retailers with high turnover. The jar that's been sitting on the shelf for 6 months has had a much larger window of opportunity for tampering than the one that was stocked yesterday. Big supermarkets that move volume quickly are statistically safer than the corner shop with dusty inventory.
Now let's put the numbers on this, because this is where the anxiety meets reality. The CDC estimate is roughly one tampered product per 100,000 in the US supply chain annually. Your chance of being struck by lightning in a given year is about 1 in 1.2 million. So tampered food is more common than lightning strikes, but we're still talking about an event so rare that it makes international news every single time it happens.
That's where probability neglect kicks in. It's a term from behavioral economics, the idea that when an outcome is vivid and horrifying, our brains stop processing the denominator. We hear babies collapse from poisoned food, and the 1 in 100,000 number becomes irrelevant. The image is too powerful. Meanwhile, the parent who's checking vacuum seals with forensic intensity is probably not thinking about the fact that improper storage temperature for homemade puree is a vastly larger actual risk to their child's health, or that choking on improperly sized food pieces sends thousands of kids to the ER every year.
The mundane risks don't make headlines because they're not intentional. There's no villain, no news conference, just a parent who left the chicken puree out too long and a kid with food poisoning. But that's the thing about probability neglect. It makes us optimize for the threat that feels most threatening, not the threat that's most likely to harm us.
Understanding the packaging isn't about becoming an amateur forensic analyst at the supermarket. It's about replacing the vague, directionless fear with something concrete. You know what to look for. You do the 10-second check. The Tylenol murders happened, and the system responded. The Jerusalem case is happening now, and the system is responding. That's how this works.
Let's make this practical. If you're a parent listening to this, and you want to walk into your kitchen right now and know what to look for, here's the checklist. First, the vacuum button on the lid. It should be fully depressed, concave, and it should not move when you press it. If it clicks, flexes, or is already raised before opening, that's a red flag. Second, the shrink band. Look for tears, glue residue, or a band that sits slightly crooked on the neck. A reapplied band rarely lines up perfectly. Third, avoid any jar with a dent near the seal rim. The glass might be intact, but the seal can be compromised without visible cracks. Fourth, buy from retailers with high turnover. The jar that's been restocked this week has had a much smaller exposure window than the one gathering dust on a corner shop shelf. And fifth, trust your nose. If the contents smell off in any way, chemical, bitter, just wrong, don't serve it. You're not being paranoid. You're being a parent.
That last one matters more than people think. Benzodiazepine has a distinctly bitter taste. An infant can't tell you it tastes wrong, but you can taste it yourself before serving. It's a small thing. It takes 2 seconds. And it's the kind of habit that catches anomalies your eyes might miss.
Here's the cognitive piece that I think actually helps people feel less afraid, not more. Treat food tampering the way we treat plane crashes. Plane crashes are vivid. They're catastrophic. They dominate news cycles. And they're so statistically rare that the safest part of your entire trip is the flight to the airport. The rational response to a plane crash is not to stop flying. It's to understand that the aviation safety system, the redundant engineering, the maintenance protocols, the air traffic control infrastructure, is what makes flying extraordinarily safe. Tampered baby food works the same way. The event is horrifying. The system that prevents it from happening to you is robust.
That system is about to get more robust. The Jerusalem case will almost certainly accelerate adoption of more sophisticated tamper-evident technologies. We're already seeing movement toward QR code-based chain of custody tracking, where you can scan a jar and see every handoff from the manufacturing line to the store shelf. Frangible labels, labels that shatter or disintegrate when someone tries to remove them, are becoming cheaper to produce. I'd expect to see packaging evolve noticeably in the next 12 to 18 months, not because the risk is high, but because the emotional salience of this case creates market pressure that a statistical risk assessment never would.
Which is the real takeaway here? The best defense against food terrorism isn't individual hypervigilance. It's the regulatory and engineering response that follows each incident. The Tylenol murders gave us tamper-evident packaging mandates that protect every medication bottle in your cabinet. The Rajneeshi attack reshaped food safety surveillance. The Chilean grape scare rewrote import screening protocols. Each crisis produced a systemic fix that made everyone safer. Not because parents got better at inspecting jars, but because the system got harder to defeat.
That's where the Jerusalem investigation matters, beyond just finding the perpetrator. Whatever regulatory gap this case exposes, whether it's in retail-level security or supply chain traceability or packaging standards for infant food specifically, that gap is going to get closed. It's already in motion. The question isn't whether the system will respond, it's how quickly and how thoroughly.
Here's where we land. Informed, not afraid, but there are still open questions worth watching, and I think they're interesting ones. Will the Jerusalem investigation reveal a perpetrator with a coherent motive, or will it join the Tylenol case in the unsolved file? Will this trigger new packaging mandates for infant food specifically, the way 1982 reshaped medication bottles? And how does the industry respond when the attack vector isn't the manufacturing floor, but a retail-level insertion?
Those are the questions I'm watching. The regulatory machinery moves slowly until something like this happens, and then it moves fast. I bet on seeing new standards for baby food packaging within 18 months. Not because the risk is high, but because the emotional weight of this case creates political pressure that no regulator wants to resist.
Here's the thing I want to leave people with. The world is full of real dangers for our children. Food terrorism is not in the top 100. It's not in the top 1,000. The reason this case made international news is precisely that it's so aberrant. And understanding why it's so rare. Understanding the packaging, the regulations, the supply chain monitoring that sits between a bad actor and your child's dinner. That understanding is itself a form of parental empowerment. You're not helpless. You're just not the primary defense.
The primary defense is the system, and the system learns. That's the point.
If this episode helped you think about this clearly rather than just anxiously, please leave us a review. It helps other parents find the show when they're asking the same questions. Next week on My Weird Prompts, we're doing something completely different, and you'll find out what that is when you hear it.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Thanks for listening.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.